Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
I'm Kaylee Cuoco.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Marlon Wayans.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
All right, I'm here with Peter Principato. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Peter is the CEO of Artists First, which is a management company and a production company, television production company, and a Quibi production company. You have such clients as Jordan Peele and F. Gary Gray and my friend Ed Helms and Kate McKinnon and Tiffany Haddish and John Chu. And the list goes on and on with, you know, Ike Barinholtz and the Blackish Trio of Kenya Barris, Anthony Anderson, and Tracy Ross. But you are the king of comedy, and I want to talk to you about comedy because we're in an interesting time, and there's a lot of speculation about comedy, especially in these crazy times, and there was a lot of speculation about comedy before these crazy times. But I want to first just very briefly discuss how you got into comedy, your love of comedy, and then kind of your career path to opening up Principato Young. So you were born in Queens, is that true?
I was born in Queens, Bayside, Queens, to be exact. Actually, I was born in Flushing, Queens, and lived in Bayside, Queens until I was about five. My parents were both from Queens, and then we moved out to Long Island. And I was going to be a doctor. I was going for pre-med through school since I was a teenager. I wanted to be a doctor, you know, and I was volunteering in hospitals and all of this stuff. But when, you know, my father and mother were very young when they had me, you know, my mother was 19, my father was, I think, 21. And they put away all things childish when they got, you know, they got married, they had a kid really quick. And, you know, my father was working a few jobs to kind of keep the family afloat. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. And when I was about, I don't know, I think it was about 9 or 10 years old, I found all of these comedy albums that my father had put far away, you know, deep into storage. And it was things like Bob Newhart and Lily Tomlin and the Smothers Brothers and, you know, just a number of different comedians and everything that were just amazing to me. And I started listening to these things and I fell in love with it. And my grandfather and grandmother lived in our house. And I'll come back to my grandfather because it's going to be a very funny story. My grandfather, who was a butcher from Queens, as far as I knew, and married my grandmother, and we all lived in this little house on Long Island. My father was a mechanic and then basically worked for the New York City Police Department in charge of their motor transport division. And, you know, my grandfather was retired. My grandmother was a retired nurse. My mother was still a stay-at-home mom. We all lived in a house. I had a brother and a sister as well. And when I was around 10, I think Saturday Night Live started, and my parents would stay up and watch it. We weren't allowed to stay up that late, but I would always like hear them laughing and, you know, doing this stuff. So I started sneaking watching this show on my little television in my bedroom when they weren't paying attention, and started, you know, between those albums and between the original Saturday Night Live, I started to develop a keen sense of comedy, like a good sense of comedy, because I fell in love with Monty Python then, and, you know, Cook Dudley Moore and Peter Cook. And, you know, I feel like I went from a really simple, you know, comedic taste to kind of a sophisticated comedic taste really quickly, where I really loved innovative people. I loved people that were creating all the time, people that were writing their own material, you know, and Richard Pryor comes along and, you know, and that sort of throws the gauntlet, and it just made me, I fell in love. I became a fan. As I was thinking of becoming a doctor, I was just a fan of comedy, comedy movies, comedy television shows. My grandfather and I would watch the Carol Burnett Show and the Smothers Brothers Show and all the variety shows from the 70s, Sonny and Cher, and all of these things. And it was just something that was a bonding thing for my grandfather and I. And my grandfather and I would, you know, take me to the movies. One of the first movies he took me to, well, aside from the Disney movies he would take us to as kids, one of the first real sort of R-rated comedies he took us to was Porky's. And would sit next to me and my friend as we're watching it, and some woman's breasts would come on, and he would just kind of needle me with his elbow, going, "You like that, don't you, kid?" You know, and it was like, you know, just started my fandom of everything comedic. I mean, I love everything. I love drama. I mean, certainly being an Italian American, The Godfather, and you know, and Martin Scorsese, growing up with those guys as filmmakers and things. I love the drama, but comedy was just always my passion. And my interest, and I was a fan. And then when I started thinking about going to medical school, my junior year of college, my fruit flies died in my genetics class. Now, I don't know if you know how to keep a fruit fly alive, but it's literally a drop of sugar water in a test tube. And I failed at that. I felt like I didn't want to go down this path of, you know, studying and another of 8 years, and can I take a human alive, and can I keep a human alive? And, you know, I went to my parents and said, and again, my father dropped out of college. My mother didn't go to college. Both of my grandparents didn't go to college. I was the first person in my family to go to college, and I was going to make something of myself. And I told them I didn't think I wanted to go to medical school, and they were very disappointed and upset. And of course, my mother said she was going to stick her head in the oven. And my wise ass response was, "It's an electric oven. The most you're going to get is a tan." And it sort of led towards, you know, a different path. And I switched over and just was really interested in communications and film and television studies. And, you know, so I switched over. And at first, I thought I was going to be either I was going to go into politics or become a publicist, because I didn't really know what that meant. I was president of the student body at school, and I was really good with people. I was a people person. I got along with many people, and you know, I just felt like I was always political in certain ways through the university and all the different changes at my university when I was there. We went through a president change and everything, and it was a very, very interesting time. And so my first job, I came out, it was I worked for the Attorney General of New York State, called, his name was Robert Abrams, and I was put onto a committee about getting people to utilize their seatbelts. This is before the seatbelt law was enacted. This is before click it or ticket or buckle up, it's the law. And my job was to take a demo tape of all these car accidents and go to corporations with like fluorescent lighting conference rooms and basically play a death tape of people dying in car accidents.
Wow.
Which of course I found hilarious. What am I doing? And I also, because I have a dark sense of humor, and I didn't really fall in love with that. Then I went quickly to a PR firm in New York. I worked there for 6 months and I didn't really like it. I didn't want to do it. And then I turned my attention to the entertainment industry. I'm 21 years old now in New York City. And the analytical side of my brain, that was the science major that wanted to be a doctor, was like, let me go do research on what's in New York. I had gotten laid off on my birthday from that PR job because the stock market had crashed and they had done a lot of corporate PR. So, you know, last one's in, first one's out. I was an account executive that was let go with a number of other people on my birthday. Again, hilarious. And I wound up going to the library of my university and just doing all this research on all these different entertainment companies, production companies, television networks, television studios. And I came upon talent agencies, which I really didn't know what they were, but I remember that Ricky Ricardo was with the William Morris Agency on I Love Lucy. Whenever he would go to his agent's office, there was a door with the William Morris Agency painted on it. And I found these four talent agencies at the time, which was one was William Morris, one was ICM, one was APA, and one was Abrams Artists. And all of them had what they called training programs. I didn't know what that was at the time. But I paper in New York City with my resume to record companies, to production companies, all these places. 125 resumes go out. I take off for London and Paris with a bunch of friends to backpack through Europe for a couple of weeks because I was free. Came back. I had 120 rejection letters from all of these places. But I had three interviews randomly out of four talent agencies I sent a resume to. Three wanted to interview me.
Wow.
And so I had interviews at ICM, I had interviews at APA, and I had interviews at Abrams Artist at the time. So I got interviews at three of the four agencies I sent a resume to. It was ICM, it was APA, and Abrams Artist. And ICM wanted to hire me in the mailroom. It was a Writers Guild strike year, so they had a hiring freeze for 6 months. I wasn't sophisticated enough at the time to realize, like, I can go pump gas for 6 months. Let me go take this job, you know, in 6 months. So I needed a job. So I wound up getting hired at Abrams Artist for, you know, starting answering phones for $13,000 a year in New York. And that was my first sort of job into the business. And while I was there, again, I started doing all this research about, I was reading the trades every day. I was just reading a thing called Celebrity Service, which was a service provided to people coming to New York of like what celebrities were coming to New York and who represented them. I was taking detailed notes about who all these people were, you know, what were they doing, who was representing who were the people I was fans of. And I was working in the commercial department then at Abrams, and this story will kill you, I think, but I started doing all this research on the agencies, and I realized, like, oh, William Morris was a big agency at the time, and I didn't, you know, CAA was only about 10 years old at this time, but William Morris was still one of the biggest and the best, and they were the ones that didn't interview me at the time, and, you know, the then president of the William Morris agency, a gentleman by the name of Lee Stevens, had passed away. And I was reading in the trades that they were having a memorial service for him at the Marriott Marquis in New York City. And I thought, here's an idea.
Oh, God.
I'm going to crash this memorial service with resumes in my pocket, and I'm going to go and get myself a job at the William Morris Agency. And so I'm a year into my job at Abrams. I get dressed in a suit that day. I turned to my people at Abrams and said, I have a funeral I have to go to. They understood it. I went to the funeral. I crashed this memorial service at the Marriott Marquis. I slip in with everybody as they're walking in, and I'm sitting in the middle of the orchestra section in the middle of a row. I'm looking around, and it's like New York celebrity debutantes, and everybody's recognizable. On stage was like Alan King and Bill Cosby, and it was either Barbara Walters or Diane Sawyer, you know, were on stage. And I'm just looking around, and everybody was like, you know, all dressed, you know, really to the T. And then they start telling these stories about this man, and they were very personal stories. And the mood was somber. People were sad. You know, there were people crying in the congregation. And I started slipping down in my chair because I felt like I am a dirtbag. I am sitting here at a wake with resumes in my pocket. And I'm like, I'm so embarrassed. I'm like, what am I doing with my life? I'm making $13,000 a year. My friends are all making $75,000, $80,000 in Wall Street, or they're at medical or law school right now. I could have went to medical school. What's happening right now? What is going on with my life? And I sat there for 3 hours because I was embarrassed to get up while I was in the middle of the orchestra section, in the middle of the row, and just sort of like, excuse me, pardon me, excuse me. And
I sat there. The only thing that would have been better is if you had already had a slide with your resume, like in with a headshot.
I slipped it into the in memoriam.
Yeah.
Well, I stayed there for 3 hours, and I went through this range of emotions of like, you know, I felt like Fred Flintstone trying to ask for a raise for Mr. Slate as he just shrinks in his chair and can't do it. And you know, I did by the end say like, God, this really feels like a family, and it really feels really warm. And, you know, this man was beloved. Who was this man? I want to be that guy that they're talking about. Who's that? You know, and I left. I didn't hand out any resumes, you know, so my conscience and my my better self came out and said, you're a f***ing dirtbag, like, don't do this, you know? And I didn't do it, but I went back to work, and I was kind of inspired of, like, okay, how do I find this a job at the William Morris Agency? And randomly, and as the universe operates in weird ways, like the universe gave me 3 interviews out of 4 at the agencies, William Morris, because this man passed away, the then head of their famous mailroom that trained Barry Diller, Bernie Brillstein, David Geffen, all of these people in New York, was a guy by the name of Ed Corey, and he was 80-something years old, and he was retiring. So at this moment in time, there was no training program in New York. So they had to hire people straight onto agents' desks. And an opening came in their commercial department, which is the department I was working in Abrams at the time. A buddy of mine got an interview, and he told me he had an interview. And I said, oh, I'd really like to hear how that interview goes. And so he went. He didn't like it. He felt it felt corporate. It felt like a law firm. It was like all this dark wood in New York. And I was like, so you're really not interested in that at all? And he's like, I'm really not interested. And I said, would you mind throwing my name into the mix on that? And he was just like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah, I'm kind of sure. I didn't tell him what I had done 2 weeks before because I was kind of embarrassed by it, obviously. And I went and interviewed, I got offered the job, and then, you know, anybody who knows starting in a mailroom or in a position on an agent's desk at William Morris, you have to type 50 words a minute. I typed with 2 fingers, so I didn't type 50 words a minute. I typed maybe the fastest was 28 words a minute with my 2 fingers at the time. You know, this is, I'm aging myself in the fact that this was before.
Oh, no. Peter, you aged yourself with the Lucille Ball reference. You Flintstone reference, the Alan Carr, and the Richard Pryor. Let's pause for 1 second because there's so much to glean and unpack here. So the 3 things that struck me in this journey so far is just the amount of research that you did in terms of just taking it upon yourself to research, to find out where the places were, what was happening in the business, what was an agency, what agencies you might like, you know, and researching what a mailroom was, researching this program, researching that there's this funeral. And then that's number one. Number two is just the balls to just go to a funeral or just put yourself out there. And the third is to ask. I mean, those are 3 things that I think people often don't do enough of, you know, either doing enough research for, you know, whatever business they want to get into or whatever direction they want to go in, and having the balls to put yourself out there. And 3, just simply ask the fucking question sometimes, like, hey, would you mind putting my name out there? Those are 3 really powerful things that you strung together to get that job at the William Morris Agency, which, by the way, isn't very easy because New York is a very small pool of players playing in the entertainment business, and super, super competitive. So I didn't want to gloss over those 3 things, and also just the research you did to figure out what you loved, that you loved comedy, and despite only bringing up comedians from the early 1930s. You
people on stage, and
you did. And by the way,
I listened to of my fathers.
And the other reference is Bernie Brillstein, which I love, and Barry Diller, and these guys that got their starts in the William Morris mailroom. It was such a prestigious thing in New York City, and the Eastern Seaboard in general, and with Saturday Night Live there, and Bernie Brillstein with being at Lauren's right hand of starting Saturday Night Live, you really were in the epicenter of comedy, and knowing what you want to do and taking those chances is a real testament to you, and something that needs to be, you know, praised, because people need to do more of that if they want to get in this business. It's super competitive, and the pool is very small and deep. And if you want to get in, you got to do those 3 things to be able to do it.
And I was looking for, again, it was happenstance, because there was a part of me that felt like I want to be a producer. I really like content. When I was in college, I was producing all these like fashion shows and all these different things, these live shows. I was booking the concerts. I was booking the comedy shows. I was like basically producing all these shows coming to campus. And I thought maybe I'd love to be a producer. I didn't know what a producer did at the time yet, but I also thought I'd want to be a writer. So going to a place like William Morris was almost just like going to graduate school in the entertainment industry. It could give me the sense of learning about the business before, and maybe I would leave to just go be a creative. And I wound up, I just wound up falling in love with it.
And so you're on a desk in the commercial department in William.
Well, before I have to just publicly, make claim to this. So I had this typing test. I get brought into the human resources. I studied. I got the books on typing. I said, I'm going to teach myself to type 50 words a minute in 4 days. Fastest I got was 32, 33 words a minute. I'm like, the adrenaline's going to kick in. I'm going to get this job. I'm going to, I'm going to type 50 words a minute. I get in there. There's nobody in the human resources department. It's a temporary person, brings me in. It's one of these cubicles with an old-time typewriter. And there's this dial that's a timer in front of me. She dials it to 5 minutes. She says, go. I hear the door close. I'm typing as fast as I can with my two fingers. I lean my chair back to see that there's nobody there. I turn the dial to 9 minutes, and I just keep typing. She comes in. She comes in. There's a minute left. I wound up typing 57 words a minute. I got the job.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
And again, and to your point, I'm 22 years old. I have nothing to lose, in this stuff. It's like, what do I really have to lose? Like, I have nothing to lose because I come from, humble beginnings. And like I said, my parents, my father left college to have a family. And he was, living off $55,000 a year, supporting a family of seven without any debt. And I just was like, I'm going after something and I'm just going to be aggressive and I'm going to be as much as I can be to get the opportunity of getting to a place that I feel like I wanted to. And things were looking over me and, I was very blessed and happy. And, so I am. I'm an assistant now. And I went straight onto a desk at 22 years old, which is also something that doesn't happen because usually you have to be in the mailroom for 2 to 3 years before you get promoted, to a desk. So I come in at 22, I'm on a desk. That's where I am.
And so how do you get into the comedy space at William Morris?
Right. So I'm there. I love as an assistant. One thing I was doing at Abrams was with a buddy. I was going to all these comedy clubs. I was going to all these comedy showcases. I was also going to all these graduating classes of the leagues and all the acting schools and just started bringing in people in commercials, So all of a sudden I'm working with, somebody like Jon Stewart or Dennis Leary on the commercial front. And, I start bringing in these actors and these comedians and handing them off to other people in the department as I'm an assistant. I'm just identifying at this time. And I didn't think I was going to go into comedy yet because I still felt like I was going to leave and I didn't want to like make that my business yet, and get known as X when I was trying to do Y. But as I was doing it, I started falling in love with this stuff. And then, by the way, when I came home and told my grandfather, because I was still living at home on Long Island in my parents' house, and my grandfather would drive me to the train station every morning and pick me up every night. I tell him, he's 85 years old. He's older. I tell him, I got a job at the William Morris Agency. And he said, oh, I knew William Morris. And I'm like, grandpa, that's adorable. It's just like, and he goes, no, from 1927 to 1931, I was a talent scout for Paramount Pictures.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? What the are you talking about? And he proceeds to tell me all these stories of his cousin was this woman that was the secretary to the president of Paramount Pictures when they were based at Silver Cup and Astoria Studios in Queens before they moved their base of operation from Queens to LA. And his cousin got married on the studio lot. He and a buddy were in the casting. They were casting associates in the talent department. And he's hanging out with all the vaudeville stars, 1927 and 1931. Oh, and when they moved their base of operation, him and his buddy, Patty DeChico, were going to go across country and go work at Paramount. He didn't have the money to go. He went to his father, who owned the butcher shop in Queens, and said, can I get, $200 to go across the country? His father said, no, you can earn it. He stays back. His buddy goes off to L.A. He stays back, meets my grandmother, never leaves. His buddy goes off to L.A., becomes this weird bigwig, and marries Gloria Vanderbilt. Gloria Vanderbilt's first husband.
Oh my
God. Was my grandfather's. Bizarre.
Information you could have used a couple years ago.
Anything. Like, you know, this is the man. Now I understood why you love going to the movies and taking me and watching television. And when he passed away, you know, which wasn't that many years after that, like, I found all of these articles about, you know, Paramount back then, and these pictures of the people in the studio, and he was in one, and now they hang in my office as just a remembrance of, you know, these things. So at 24, I'm in William Morris now for 2 years. An opening comes up to be an agent in the commercial department. And I had so many interests. I was going to meetings in the talent department. I was going to meetings in the comedy department. I was going to meetings in the television packaging department just to learn. Like I was saying, it was going to be my master's degree. And people liked me. And the then head of the William Morris Motion Picture Department on the East Coast said, listen, don't try to get into the talent department and get promoted there. Everybody's trying to do that. Get promoted at the company. And then, you know, then prove what you can do, and you can then move different departments. And I thought that was probably the best piece of advice I had ever gotten while I was there. And I demanded, again, at 24 years old, I demanded to be promoted when the opening happened. And, you know, people really liked me, but they're like, you know, you're not going to be promoted. And the guy that was about to run the department took 5 years to get promoted. I'm only doing it 2 years. A lot of the department heads really liked me, just personality-wise, and just because I was sort of, they felt my ambition, they saw my interest, they saw my willingness to learn how hard I was working. The fact that I was paying the two gals next to me to type my booking slips because I couldn't type, and I was paying them a quarter a booking slip so that they could do my job for me, and, you know, and I just took care of them. And so I got promoted when I was 24. And that's when I said, you know what, I really like this. And I started really hitting the comedy clubs. And then I, as a result, we started a big comedy division at the agency that was made up of people from all the different divisions. So there was somebody from talent, somebody from packaging, somebody from film, somebody from endorsements and commercials. So I was the guy from that side to go into the comedy department. And then I just started signing people. You know, I was just out there signing. I signed the Upright Citizens Brigade. I signed Zach Galifianakis. I signed Louis C.K. and Mitch Hedberg. I was, you know, Dave Becky and I were very close at that time because he was a manager in New York. I was an agent in New York. We shared a lot of business together. And I started bringing in these people that at that point weren't really a business. People were calling them alternative comics. And alternative meant we don't know how to make money with. Because these were all guys that were going up and they were in that, you know, sort of Lenny Bruce, you know, sort of George Carlin type of comics that were writing material on the fly, getting up on stage and telling stories. They weren't doing just the traditional, my act is my television show. Like, and, you know, there's great comics that do that, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, Ray Romano, Kevin James, these guys, their stand-up had to do with their lives. And you could see their television shows that would go around them because they would talk about it in their act. The people I was signing were people that were just, you know, telling stories about carrots and, you know, that day, whatever the cake tasted like, or, you know, a drug paraphernalia story. And, you know, everybody was just like, what are you doing? You're not going to sign business like that. You're not going to make any money with those people. And as I was doing this, I had signed this other sketch group called, it was a group called Live on Tape. It was Artie Lang was one of the first members of this group. And, you know, obviously he went on to Howard Stern and a number of movies and things like that. And I represented this group. And at the time, NBC was negotiating with Lorne Michaels. They were renegotiating his deal. And it was at a sort of lower end of the SNL ratings years. And there was some conversations of, like, you know, as they were negotiating with him, oh, let's develop a show that could either go behind SNL or, you know, if we can't make the deal with Lorne, maybe something happens with this other show. The people I represented all of a sudden became the hot ticket in town. And at a midnight show, I had all the heads, Warren Littlefield and, you know, John Agolian and all NBC, ABC, Fox, all these networks were coming to see the show, had offers from four networks and made a deal with NBC to shoot 10 episodes of the show. This is my first big deal, Okay. My first big foray comedy, it put me on, you know, Lorne Michaels was obviously a hero of mine. The only person I ever sent a fan letter to was Lorne Michaels when I was 16, saying I'd sweep floors at the studio. Of course, I never heard back from him. And so this show winds up selling. We wind up shooting the show at Studio 8H during the summer. During the hiatus, we shoot 10 episodes. We start organizing it. Don Olmeyer is running the network at the time. It was such a learning experience because Lorne Michaels was calling to want to produce that show. Who am I to say no to my hero, Lorne Michaels? But I'm saying no to Lorne Michaels because I knew the network, you know, had this other agenda going on with him. And it was this whole agenda, political situation. And it was at the time that CNBC and MSNBC was starting, and then Don Olmeyer was going to, they owned their time slots, you know, every night from 11:30 till 1 a.m. Every night, including Saturday. On Saturday, they gave back they owned it from 11:30 to 2 a.m. And they gave the 1 a.m. to 2 a.m. back to the O&Os, the owned and affiliates, the affiliate stations. And they wanted to maybe put this show that they fell in love with behind Saturday Night Live, but they had to now go. They didn't own the time anymore, and they had to go to the O&Os, and everybody loved it. It was going to go behind. And then Don Olmeyer sold Conan O'Brien to MSNBC and CNBC, and the affiliates went crazy that this was their revenue stream, that he was f***ing with it. So this little show that we shot 10 episodes of died, went nowhere,
wow.
Just sat there. But it put me on Lauren's map a little bit, and the people at Broadway Video started a relationship with me. And, you know, one of the guys at Broadway Video, I did wind up hiring to produce that show, even though it wasn't Lauren, you know, because I was still trying to take care of the person I was, you know, sort of the two people I knew from the business before were Bernie Grillstein and Lorne Michaels, you know, before I even got in the business. And so I basically started talking to them. And they were interested in maybe starting a management division in New York at the time. And maybe myself, maybe a Dave Becky, maybe a Ruth Ann Secunda. These are people that were working in comedy in New York. Maybe we would start one together. And they made offers to us. And, you know, Ruth Ann and Dave stayed where they were at the time. And I kept talking to them. And then I came to a tipping point and a crossing point. Now I'm 28 years old. I've been an agent now for 4 years. I, you know, started to get the reputation of having a good eye for talent, comedians, and actors. And I also represented everybody on MTV at the time because I was the youngest person and nobody knew what MTV was. You know, so it was like I was representing Daisy Fuentes, Dan Cortez, John Norris, Serena Hulchel, Kurt Loder, you know, Allison Stewart, Downtown Julie Brown, all of these people. I was making their deals and starting to build brands around them and all of this stuff. And so I had this pocket of comedy, this pocket of personalities, this pocket of actors. And I went to them and I just said, look, I see what Johnny Planko does, who was a big movie agent in New York that represented, like, you know, Robert Altman and John Malkovich and Theodore Aldrich, who was a costume designer. He was in the incoming phone call business, but he was representing filmmakers, actors, directors, writers, and he was in the incoming phone call business. And I went to them and said, I'd like to do that in the outgoing phone call business. I want to represent the people I'm representing because the comedians, especially, were writers, they were actors, they were directors, they were producers, you know, they were doing it all. And I wanted to represent them as a whole. I didn't understand the concept of representing one aspect of them. And they said, we're not set up that way. And I just said, that's okay. I'll give you a year. 28 years old. I'm going to the William, hey, William Morris, 100 years old, the most successful agency in the business. Like, here's the thing. This 28-year-old punk is telling you, I think you're set up the wrong way. And this is the way I would like to do it. And so a year went by, and they came back to me, and they said, okay, we're going to allow you to do that. I was like, wow, that's amazing. And, you know, they didn't realize I was having these conversations with Broadway Video at the time for a while. And, you know, my contract was only about me being an agent, not being a manager. And they said, we're going to let you do this, but we're going to cut your salary in half. And I was just like, that doesn't make any sense at all. It's obvious, like, you know, there was a lot of people who liked me, but I didn't have that real internal godfather there. Like a lot of people that really work through the agency system, you have your high-level godfather that sort of anoints you and sort of, you know, gives you the sort of sword on the shoulder maneuver of making you royalty. I didn't have that. I was a little bit of an all, you know, I was a little bit of like I do a little bit of everything type of guy. They didn't understand that. And so I said, well, I really appreciate it. Thank you. I quit. And they didn't realize I had an offer to go start my first management company as Principano Management Entertainment under the brand of Broadway Video. And Lauren became my partner.
Wow. So let me ask you a question. For comedy, what does a manager do? What is the difference between a manager and an agent for comedy specifically?
Yeah, well, I liken it to, let's look at high school for a second, which we know the entertainment industry is based on. It's a high school. Who's popular? Who's doing what? Okay. So an agent, you have your agents. They're like your subject teachers. Okay. You have your math teacher. You have your science teacher, your gym teacher, you have your English teacher. Those are your agents that if you do multiple things, then you have your guidance counselor. You have the person that's looking at as all of those things and looking at how are you making a path to success post high school, post college, post, you know, all of these different things. So a manager is more like a guidance counselor and an agency is more like a subject teacher, you know, and you need them both in certain ways, in certain capacities. But what a manager really does with comedians, it's very different. And every comic is different from what they need from a manager. One might be, you're going to see their act, you're helping them hone their act, you're helping them build the confidence they need to continue their act, you're moving them into little acting jobs here and there, you're helping them get those acting teachers, you're helping them develop ideas that they can do for themselves, you're getting them writing because they don't believe they can be writers, they don't understand that they can be writers at the time, but they're writing their own jokes every week. So you just start helping them, mold them into an entity, a person that can do many things. So they can be starring in television shows or starring in movies. They can be, you know, producing and writing and creating television shows and writing movies. They then can become directors, some of them, because they have these ambitions and they start doing that. And you really start working with them and you start finding which pathway becomes the pathway of least resistance to build a foundation. And then you get that foundation and then you can build off that foundation. So
pre-pandemic, what has been your North Star as a manager? And you know, I know all your clients are different and I agree with you. I feel like, especially in comedy and especially with comics, I mean, they have to write and generally it works out best if they write for themselves, at least in some way or fashion, even if it's just a dialogue polish or something like that, because they know their brand of comedy. Or if they're just a really good person at improv, you know, they can probably take the words and then make them their own on the fly. But in terms of you giving career advice to, let's just say, young comics or even some comics that are, you know, just already on their way, in general, what is your North Star in terms of just, you've been doing this long enough and you've shaped enough and been part of enough hugely successful careers. What advice do you normally give somebody pre-pandemic, you know, in terms of like, hey, look, here's in general where you need to be headed?
In the beginning, I was just representing people that I thought were talented, people that I would just get that feeling in the base of my spine that they were really good at what they do. They were doing something candidly that I couldn't do. So I thought they were good, you know, and each section of comedy is a little different, you know, but the advice is pretty similar. So you have stand-ups, which is a different one path in comedy. They're writing their own jokes. They're going out on the road. They're performing live in front of an audience, you know. You have your sketch performers, which are usually group-oriented, like they're writing scenes. They're doing things together. They're creating characters, you know, and they're getting a little more acting experience on the stage. And then you have your improvisational comedians that are, you know, and the Groundlings and Second City and UCB, they're all a different style of improv, but they all come down to the Groundlings about creating more character-based things. The UCB is more grounded, realistic, listening, long-form improv. So they all have different skill sets that they come out with when they're in comedy. So, but each of them are all about that North Star for me is working with somebody who has many ambitions, who wants to act, who wants to create, who wants to write, who may want to direct, and who may want to produce. So the people that I wind up gravitating towards are ambitious, you know, because sometimes you can be more ambitious on behalf of your client than they are for themselves just because they don't have the confidence in certain areas, so you need to bring it out in them. And some have a lot of confidence that they feel they can go anywhere and they can do these things, but they don't have any clue on how to do it. So you really start, you know, for us, and to build a business. Now I started Principato Management Entertainment. That was 24 years ago. It was me in an office with an assistant and one other manager in New York. That was it, okay? And I started representing all these people I liked. And it was an incredible experience because it put my name out there. I wasn't just Peter from William Morris anymore. I was this guy, Principato, that was representing all these new voices that people wanted to know about, people wanted to get involved in. This is the heyday when you had 7 minutes of some comedy, you can get a $1 billion development deal at a network. So it was a very vibrant business. It was the quickest way to build a business. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to focus on comedy first, coming out of my William Morris experience, was it was the fastest way to build a business. And, you know, the types of people I was working with at the time, people like Tom Lennon and David Wayne and Artie Lang and, you know, Dimitri Martin, these were all guys that were up on stage doing stand-up, doing sketch, doing improv. You know, they were doing a little bit of it all. And, you know, they started working. So I started honing and focusing on turning them into ideas. And we started staging shows that they were creating. We started honing their stand-up to be sitcoms. You know, we started getting them actually writing short form first. And I was putting them all together. So I was putting like a like-minded writer with a like-minded performer with a like-minded director and just getting them creating material because I needed stuff to go out and sell to the marketplace. So we just started doing, you know, it was just that ambitious of like, let's do it. Let's put it together. Let's go, let's do it, you know?
Right.
And it's interesting what you were saying about, you know, a lot of people say, follow your gut. It's an instinct thing. What's fascinating about comedy and horror and those two genres specifically is, you know, the human body has been around for millions of years, and the human intellect has not. The intellect has been something that's developed fairly recently in our history, and our instinct to run, or instinct to be scared, or instinct to be pleasure, you know, in pleasure or being amused, has always been in our DNA. And there is something that is just, and you feel in your body when you connect with somebody, you know, with talent that literally tickles your funny bone. It's a genetic thing we have in our body when you feel a comic touch you, and mm-hmm. and it's not an intellectual thing at all. It is something that that's why they call it, you know, feeling it in your gut. It's a really interesting, just who you connect with and who you feel tickled by. It's, you know, I've always been fascinated by that.
Well, it's that visceral reaction. It's that person who makes you laugh, or that you feel like, oh, she's got my sense of humor, he's got my sense of humor, you know, or they're doing things that you haven't seen before, and then your eyes go wider because it's like, you know, it's like, I've never seen that before. I'm witnessing this, you know, and it's like a testament, you know, right, of doing that stuff. And that can be in stand-up, sketch, or improv. When you see some of the best improvisational people in town do really good improv, it will blow your mind that, you know, yeah, they just came up with what they just came up with in literally a millisecond, you know, right, in response to something. And a stand-up who's crafting a joke, and he takes you on this journey, and whether they're a storyteller or they're a joke teller, you know, like Stephen Wright or Mitch Hedberg or Dimitri Martin, they were all about the crafting of a joke, you know, and the joke itself was the ride. And when you get there, you're like, that's hilarious, you know, right. And then you have your storytellers that are just sharing their lives with you and pointing out and making you feel like, oh, I'm not the only douche that feels this way out there, you know? Right. And you're identifying with it. But comedy, Lorne Michaels always said this, and I really feel like it's true. It's like what he loves in casting his show is he loves letting the audience discover their people. Comedy is like bands. Comedy is like rock stars. Everybody has that band that was their band when they were growing up, you know? And people want to feel that way about their comedic star. It's like, who is their rock star in that world? Who's their person? So it's usually people that are about their age and are coming up and have an opportunity, and then you stay with them for 20 years, 30 years, you know?
Right.
So whether it's Billy Crystal or Robin Williams and the people that followed him, and then, you know, Adam Sandler and, you know, the next group of people, Will Ferrell, like, all these people discover them, whether it's SNL or, you know, their stand-up or their stand-up specials, all right. that stuff.
Right. So pre-pandemic, I found it really not funny because it was ridiculous, but a lot of the press was like, well, comedy's dead.
Yep.
You know, then you can look at comedy's dead, and yep. You know, the movies and the comedic movies are not working. And it was so insane to me because you and I both know, being on the other side of that fence, comics, even pre-pandemic, were doing better than they've ever done in their entire lives.
Yes.
Between the money they're making in stand-up specials, the money you can make on YouTube, the money you can make doing television, the money you can make doing streaming, the money you can make doing movies, the money, yeah. I mean, you have a Quibi show. And like, so yeah. It was so interesting to me how myopic the media is about comedy. It's like, well, you know, these comedies that were making $100 million before are only making $70 million worldwide now. It's like, okay, well, you're also forgetting the fact that we have, you know, not only 500 channels, but multiple streamers, Quibi, YouTube, Instagram, Snapchat, and, you know, all of these places where not only are comics promoting themselves, but they're selling tickets. They're selling tickets to their stand-ups. They're selling tickets to their specials. They're moving their audiences around different formats. Yeah. And comedy had never been more vibrant. Yes, it was much more challenging to get a comedy movie open, you know, to the $30, $40 million like we used to, when there was no other game in town and when you had to sit in a theater. And by the way, it's great to sit in a theater and laugh with 400 people, for sure. But you can go to a stand-up show now and do that, or you can go to a movie, or quite frankly, there's nothing that's so wrong with being at home and laughing by yourself. I mean, you know, I'm obviously love comedy more, probably more than most people. And I haven't been to a live big concert show in a long time, but I have seen every single one. And I can tell you, gosh, even when I was like at, you know, the co-president of Disney, and, you know, could go to any concert show I wanted, you know, and was invited to every single one, didn't see as much comedy as I do now, because it's just so easy to see comics. And so you being on the inside and literally being in the trenches with them, walk me quickly through like the last 4 or 5 years of the evolution of comedy and kind of where you saw things going at the time before this pandemic hit.
You know, it's always like, you know, as somebody who's been in comedy as long as you have, both as an executive and as a producer, you know, you see these ebbs and flows that go on in comedy. And when the trades and the papers are talking about comedy, it's always about films. It's always about the movie business, because comedies on television still work. You know, comedies in other arenas still work. So it's always this myopic view that comedy is dying in the feature film world. And, you know, the truth is the experience of going to theaters 4 years, 5 years ago, we started seeing the experience of going to movie theaters was starting to change, because people had more access to content through their phone, through their computer. They were able to watch movies at home now. They were raising kids instead of going out and getting a babysitter. They were making it a family event. And, you know, the experiential aspect to what comedy was changing, you know. And even the live world, when I first started my management company, the live world in stand-up, the stand-up bookings, that had hit its lowest, that had hit rock bottom, you know. And right before this pandemic, it was probably at the highest it's ever been, you know,
for sure.
The amount of people, the amount of money that people could, you know, Kevin Hart is the perfect example of somebody who can sell out stadiums now.
Oh, by the way, even guys like Sebastian Maniscalco,
he's
not He's not headlining. He's not headlining a movie. And guess what? He can, and he doesn't ever have to. I mean, these guys are making so much money with so low impact. It's them, a microphone, and you know, some form of transportation to get them to their shows, and using directly connecting with their fans, having to do no, you know, billboards. I mean, even though Netflix always does, but like these guys are just, and women are just reaching out to their fans directly, connecting with their fans directly, giving them, you know, Bert Kreischer, who I'm doing a television show with on Netflix, there's not 20 minutes that goes by where he's not connecting with his fans.
Yeah. But, you know, to your point, it's like, you know, what we started seeing about 4 years ago was that direct connection to your fans, whether it be those live shows, whether it be Instagram, whether it be Twitter, you know, whether it be any of these forms of, you know, again, a comedian, like a writer needs to write, a comedian needs to do comedy, you know, and all these different ways of doing comedy, all these different, you know, things to just get seen, people making their own videos, people making their funny music videos, people putting their stand-up on, you know, online, you know, all of these things, like, even the experience of, you know, producing Key and Peele, which we did, which, you know, was one of the joys of my life, you know, as well as an incredible thing to witness from beginning to end, the way we put it together and the way those guys really took to task and what it became and, you know, and certainly what they've become afterwards. You know, it's just one of those things of like they were seen on Comedy Central probably to about 1 million people a week. Their videos that people were showing has been seen by 1 billion people worldwide.
Yep.
You know, and so, you know, comedy is always evergreen in the sense of there's always going to be an outlet. People want to laugh. People want to forget about the shit that's going on in their lives. People want, and it's just the different venues and avenues that we have now. And that for us, it's about the diversity. You know, and that's what we try to expand with our clients now is the diversity of how they're getting that comedy directly to their fan base, whether it's writing a book, whether it's doing a stand-up tour, whether it's making shorts, building a YouTube channel, you know, having this direct experience, you know, on top of still working in the traditional film and television world.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, Adam Sandler, who I've built – you know, a very big part of my career around and have had a lot of success. My biggest successes, both just in joyousness and in just in terms of financial gain, have been through him. Yeah. And him going to Netflix was seen at the moment like, well, of course it's Adam Sandler, you know, close the curtain, and he's bigger than ever and doing more and being more artistic than ever. And his stand-up shows are gigantic, and he's flexing all of the different muscles that he's always had in ways that are fluid and easy. And, you know, when before all this streaming stuff existed, you know, Sandler did some stand-up and but where he flexed his music muscle was at his Christmas party. You know, we all got to enjoy watching Adam Sandler for an hour and a half sing songs and go, Jesus, that guy is fucking talented. And now you can watch him do his, you know, 100% fresh, and you're like, Jesus, that guy is fucking talented. And then he goes on Jimmy Kimmel from his living room, and it's like, wow. And so what I love about this, even this is pre-pandemic, by the way, what I loved about it was, even though it was harder for a traditional comedy film producer to get these comedies made at the prices that you used to get them made before, because it was the only game in town, you know, I still love making them. And you know, and if everybody's willing to be reasonable and be cost conscious and make sure that everybody, because it's a fucking investment, if everybody can get out and make some money, then it's fine. And that's the thing that the media doesn't understand. It's like, this is not the end all be all. The theater, the theatrical experience is the first stop on the train, you know? So, you know, it's perfectly, you know, nobody expects a genre, not horror, but like a, you know, a period drama to go out and, you know, break the box office every time out. It's the first stop to get, you know, something great out there. And then you have a movie like Parasite that just comes along and just slaughters everything. Even in the feature world, I don't mind it. And I'm really excited about all the different ways. I've made so many, like I said, I've made you know, three or four movies on Netflix. I've got two TV series on Netflix right now. You know, I would love to do something with Jeffrey on Quibi. I'm making comedies all over town in different ways. It's an exciting time to be into comedy, even before the pandemic.
100%. And it's something that, you know, and look, I've been doing this now 30 years, you know, and it's been an incredible ride of watching the change in the business, watching the evolution and continuing to grow with it, because it's just about being able to have a little bit of vision of what's to come. And as you're saying, Adam Sandler is a perfect example, okay, of what I was talking about, with somebody who's ambitious, somebody who's talented, somebody who's self-generating, you know? And now he's got this incredible company that he's just literally putting out. He's never stopping working for a while, wow. You know? And yeah. And it's extraordinary to sit there and watch it. He's earned that, you know?
Yeah.
He has earned it. And it's that aspect of betting on yourself. Adam Sandler has bet on himself. He's always bet on himself. And when comics, or even when personality and performers like Dwayne Johnson or, you know, Kevin Hart on the comedy side, when you bet on yourself and you're putting yourself out there, you know, as long as you're doing really good work and you're talented and you're out there, you know, there is going to be a payback for that, you know? And today with comedies, especially on the feature side, if people are betting on themselves and taking a chance at doing things that they're passionate about rather than just looking for, I mean, we always want our clients to get paid, but it's not just looking for the payday. It's about being smart. So those paydays come for many years rather than 1 year, you know? And it's trying to build that mechanism that people are betting on themselves. And that's when you start getting into people helping them build their production companies. Will Arnett's got a vibrant production company. Ed Helms has a vibrant production company. You know, Michael Showalter has a vibrant production company right now. Lennon and Grant, you know, like them, us doing this Reno 911 back for Quibi, it's one of the things that are really working for Quibi and people are excited about because it works in those short form spurts, you know?
And it's the lowest impact thing to get into if you're a young person wanting to do this, because it just takes literally just, I mean, Kevin James would remind me all the time, you know, I'm good, man. I just give me a mic and a car and you know, I'll survive the apocalypse. Well, it's true. And they don't need a car anymore, you know? And so let's move into the pandemic, which is so fascinating to me, because by far every bit of research that is being done says that the biggest thing everybody is consuming right now is comedy. The biggest thing is comedy. And what's so funny is it's not just that they're consuming the content, the movies and the television, which they are. They've devoured, you know, The Office for the 37th time, Friends. Right. I mean, all these old shows they're devouring, these new shows, every comedy special is being devoured. But you can see these comics are doing things remotely. They're doing things from their house that are funny. Saturday Night Live's doing stuff from the house. They're doing stand-up specials from their house. They're doing charity things. Sandler, you know, feels like he has a new song every week that crushes the internet. So what's amazing is you and I have known it, but now the world is like, we might need more comedy. So what do you think post-pandemic is going to happen in the comedy business?
Well, I think, you know, it's vastly different than it was just 9 weeks ago. 9 weeks ago, as you said, people are saying comedy's dead, especially in the feature world, you know, and all of this stuff. Everything I've been hearing towards, and every executive, every producer I'm talking to, even the stuff that we're developing, it's like people are going to want to laugh coming out of this. You know, people aren't going to want to watch bleak programming as much anymore. They, you know, this has been a really rough time for everybody, and it's a really sort of interesting, bleak time that people are trying to just cope with and deal with. So being able to laugh, whether it's a short-form show or a movie, you know, I had somebody over last night for a socially distant movie night, and we watched, the Wrong Missy with David Spade, you know, just because we were going to watch Extraction or The Wrong Missy, two vastly different movies that everybody wanted to laugh. You know?
Although weirdly, both movies, the lead character dies. No, I'm kidding. I don't know either. I haven't seen either yet.
Hilarious.
And what's interesting is, this was a thing that was so fascinating in terms of, and I've been saying it for years about the theatrical experience, which is, even if the trend continues that, you know, because you and I hear pretty much every day. Well, is it theatrical worthy? Even if it's not, and even if the theater experience is different, and even if people are, you know, nervous to go back, which I'm not even convinced they are. And by the way, I just read a thing where it turns out most, even for a huge blockbuster, most of the theaters in the country were never more than 3/4 full, which is awesome news, because that means that we can get back to work with these social distancing things in the theaters and still make money. But even that, and I've been saying for years, comedy is different than horror, because everybody used to say, well, there's two things that everybody has to do in a theater. You got to laugh together in a theater, and you got to be scared together in the theater. And what I realized first from my own experience, and then I really studied it, going back to your research thing to really deep dive into it, is that's not true. You can absolutely laugh by yourself. What is harder to do is be by yourself in the dark watching something that scares the shit out of you. Because then you're like, I can't watch this anymore. This is terrifying. I need to be around people. But I'm even thinking coming out of this. Yes, I hope that people go, man, let's take some shots with some comedies like we did back in the day. Like, you know, the movies you were talking about that impacted you. Let's take some shots. By the way, if they don't, or if they take the shot and they do decide for it to go to streaming, you know, these things are massively popular forever. And like you said, they're evergreen, which means you put them in your library and you play them again and again and again. You mentioned Dudley Moore. I can watch Arthur anytime, any day of the week. And not only does it hold up, in fact, it's like you would say it's ahead of its time, because some of the shit he's doing in Blake Edwards' movie 10 and Arthur are so much more than we're doing in comedy now on screen. Yeah. Although I love shows like Dave and things like that are taking these big risks like they used to. And by the way, Dave's on FX and everybody fucking saw it and everybody talked about it. And it was a water cooler thing, if water coolers could exist in this moment. And I think that what I hope all of the buyers get to is, don't have to make that fucking decision out of the gate if it's fucking theatrical or not. Don't keep asking that question, because you're just asking the same question and you're going to get the same answer. You're going to talk yourself out of something that could be great. Yeah. Make something that makes you laugh and make something that you feel is funny. Go with that primordial gut. And if it appeals to you, fucking make it. And then you figure it out. Most of these companies now have a way to recoup. These days, there's so many ways to recoup and put something in a library that lasts for a long time. And I just feel like, I hope coming out of this, seeing the data and just their own family, we need it. We need to laugh. It's so important.
But also letting people, you know, the only thing I'd add to that is letting people discover what this stuff is, because even our biggest movie stars right now, and our biggest comedic stars, you know, they're 50 years old, 60 years old in certain ways, you know, and it's like, and that's not a bad thing. You still have fans and they're still going to make product and they're still talented and they should get those opportunities. But like I was saying, the experiential aspect of people that want to go to the movies, that want to discover things for themselves, you know, and not just be spoon-fed something, are the people that when you look at, you know, something like when Borat came out, it was a reality show that they put on the screen, and it went bonkers because nobody had seen it before. They discovered him for the first time, and the audience felt like it was a discovery. You know, Girls Trip, you hadn't seen a movie like that in a while with you know, four African-American women, like in a movie that appealed to a mass audience, you know. And it's that feeling of that discovery of, okay, Tiffany Haddish was discovered in that, Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids. And as long as the movies are qualitatively good and are innately performed by people who make an audience laugh, you know, you'll always have your movie stars that you want to build movies around, but you also have to give the audience what they want, which is discovering, why is Sebastian Maniscalco a huge stand-up? Because people have discovered him. You know, and he hasn't translated over yet. He's, you know, they're working on that, but they've discovered him, you know. And it's that aspect of audiences need to feel like they're so sophisticated now, you know, and the aspect that there's so much information at people's fingertips and they're so sophisticated. It's almost like, you know, people go to the movies and be like, you know, they sit there with their arms folded going, entertain me. and they dare us, you know? And it's like, or make us laugh, make us scream. I dare you to make us scream, you know? And that's why the genres have to keep evolving, and that's why the filmmakers have to keep evolving, and the stars have to keep evolving. Because it's one of those things of, you know, and there's always a place for everybody. There's a lot of work to go around. There's a lot of opportunities for everybody, you know? It's just the studios specifically, and, you know, even some of the television studios, are they're dangerously like dinosaurs trudging through tar right now. And hopefully they'll be able to come out of it on the other side with the aspect of, like, this is how, why did we start a studio? Why was the studio started? To make money, we know that, but also to entertain, to make people forget, you know, the bullshit of their real lives, to go out and laugh or love or feel, you know, things that they're not feeling in their lives. And it's not just, you know, the package or the number of jokes per page or the three set pieces and who's the star that we can build it around. The movie stars, as you know, Todd, is, you know, the movies are becoming the stars in some way. Between Marvel and all these things, and even the horror films and the Marvel movies, they're the stars, and we have incredibly talented people performing them, you know? But it's like, they're the stars now.
Yeah. So what advice are you giving to your clients right now during this pandemic? And I would imagine that would then translate into if somebody was just trying to figure out how to break into comedy or whatever. What advice are you giving them, given that everybody's locked down and, you know, we're all sort of chomping at the bit to get back, but we're all sort of reset as well?
Yeah. Right now, it really is about generating. Writing, you know, we have a number of clients that are finally have the time because it's a dead time that are putting together podcasts about their point of view, their thing. You know, even though the podcast market is getting saturated, it's still going to continue. And it's still, if something's good and somebody's funny, it's going to be found, you know. And writing scripts, writing a movie, writing a television script. Let's develop our, you know, are you interested in writing a book? Let's start thinking about what that looks like. Let's start thinking about what the next, you know, project that you want to be involved looks like. Let's keep going on the things that we have in development. We're very lucky that we do represent a lot of writers as well. And during this time, writers are still working. Writers are still getting hired for open writing assignments, and people are still buying pitches and, you know, all of that stuff. So we have everybody on, you know, on guard of making sure that we're helping them generate some of their expenses.
And what you said was so crucial, which is have a point of view and make it your point of view, because that's the only thing you have that's going to make you different. It's going to make you stand out in this land of so much content. Everybody's always, well, how is it going to break out? Well, you can be totally different and have a unique voice and come at it from only the perspective that you can come at it. That's the thing you have that you can fall back on.
Well, it's like I said, it's this ebb and flow of things. And the thing I can't, you know, the hardest question to get when you're developing with creators and showrunners and world creators is, what are they looking for? And it's like, I try to instill in our clients and our team, it doesn't matter what they're looking for, they'll know it when they see it. What are you looking for? You know? And it's not an easy line to distinguish, because people are so used to it. Just tell me what they want and I'll do it because I'm talented. And it's like, well, how about, what would you want to do if you had, you know, carte blanche and somebody just gave you a checkbook? You know? What would you do? Like, you know, and trying to get them to readjust the you know, the things of looking at this stuff. You know, it's really funny because Bernie Brustein, as we mentioned, when I first read his first book, and I opened it up and the first chapter talks about, I started in the William Morris commercial department, and I left William Morris because I felt they were myopic and they wanted me to do one thing. And then I looked at that thinking, this is such a unique experience to me, but I'm a 40-year-old cliche, and it's going to continue to keep going, you know? And it's like, you have to just be yourself, invent yourself, have your point of view, stick with it, and go make something happen from it.
Yeah. Exactly, which is exactly what you did. So we're coming full circle back to those three pieces of advice that you gave early on. So I always ask this at the end.
Yeah.
You've had a long and storied career, my friend. And so you've met with and you've guided and you've consoled and you've commiserated and celebrated with a lot of different comedians. Best moment that you've had in comedy?
Free Cut the Mind. You know, the first one, which we talked about, was me selling that first, you know, sketch show to NBC for 10 episodes, and just the amount of people that were involved in it and how much it was a whirlwind through town. The next was probably the going to see The Hangover for the first time, having put Ed Helms in it, because I was Zach Galifianakis' first agent, and I was a producer on What Hot American Summer, which was Bradley's first movie.
Amazing.
So I had a real stake in that, like what I felt like was a personal stake in that, and so I felt, you know, it just felt that was such a good feeling, you know. And this is going to sound more generic, but it's like, but it really still gets me. It just gets me every time. It's like when you sell that first thing with that comedic voice that you're representing, and you sell the thing that they were most passionate about.
Ah, me too.
I love that. Whether
me
it's
too.
Ring of 911, Will Arnett did a series called Flaked, you know, like Key and Peele. Like all of these things were things that we really honed, focused, developed, nurtured, and stood by their passion for what they wanted to do.
That's why I love working with first-time directors so much too, is it's just so energizing to see that process through their eyes again. It's so great. Well, brother, thank you so much for doing this. You are a mensch, and you are a great friend, and I knew that I would get the answers I was looking for by having you on. Thank you, brother. I really appreciate it. Stay safe and stay well, okay?
Thank you, Todd. This was a thrill. This was a little, like, bucket list thing, so thank you.
Awesome, brother. Thank you. Take care.